You're listening to Unterwegs, the En Route podcast, where we talk about what it means to be en route with Jesus in our day-to-day life. Navigating life and faith in our complex and changing society is hard. Our goal is to keep you unterwegs with Jesus, moving forward as you follow God's calling on your life. I am Mike Piccinato, and in this series, we are talking with Stephen and Jenny Jones, founders and staff with Exigent Communication, as they prepare to move with their family to Berlin, Germany, and join the staff of Envision Berlin. The springboard for our conversations is Stephen's book, Transitions Across Cultures, and his Cross-Cultural Transition Handbook, which can be tailored to fit the needs of cross-cultural ministry organizations. This episode was recorded in advance with Stephen and Jenny while they were still in transition in their home before they were moving here to Berlin. And since the episode has been recorded, Stephen and Jenny have moved to Berlin, and you can see some pictures of that in the show notes. We're really glad to have them here. In this episode today, we'll be talking a little bit more about culture and what is culture, and we'll be exploring tacit knowledge and a few other pieces of that, and we'll jump right into the show and you can pick it up from where we left off last week. One of the things you talk about in the chapter on culture is tacit knowledge. How would you describe tacit knowledge?
It's the stuff that we know that we don't know that we know. And this is one of the things that I think can be really difficult in cross-cultural interactions, is when we know things culturally and we don't know that we're knowing them culturally, we assume that they're universally true. So, you know, what does it mean? And some of these examples we've been talking about would apply to this, but, you know, what does it mean when you look me in the eye when we talk? I have kind of this tacit awareness that it means respect in my culture. But then there are other cultures that have a tacit awareness that looking somebody in the eyes when you're talking to them means disrespect. And sometimes it's made explicit, right? We'll say, I feel like you're disrespecting me right now because you are either looking me in the eyes or not. But often that's happening kind of outside our awareness. And when that's happening outside of our awareness, it's part of that. It's part of those shortcuts that we were talking about. But it's just kind of known without being said. So I think maybe a clearer example, well, COVID has changed this, but only a little bit, actually, is how far away we stand from one another when we're speaking. Occasionally when somebody really steps outside of the norm, if they're like a super close talker, then people will talk about it. But other than that, you just kind of know roughly how far apart to stand from someone. And it's interesting, even as people are saying, well, okay, well, I'm done with the 2 meters or 6 feet, you know, whatever of difference. They're not saying I'm ready to get back to 18 to 24 inches of space. You know, I'm just getting ready to get back to normal. But normal is culturally defined, and it's so much part of that tacit awareness that I think most of us probably couldn't name the distance that we're comfortable speaking. And even that is something between Nebraska and Minnesota is different. Minnesotans stand a little bit further apart while they're talking. And even the angle of your bodies, you know, how are you facing directly towards each other? Are you both, you know, side by side facing something, you know, or is there some angle in between those? That's almost never spoken, right? So it's this, and yet if you do it wrong, it's awkward and it affects the relationship in a material way. Even though, you know, if I was having a conversation with somebody and we had different strategies for how you should stand and where you should look and, you know, those kinds of things, I might come away from that interaction feeling like, I don't know if I really trust that person, but I might not be able to say why.
Another example might be, I remember the resting pose for a lot of farmers in central Minnesota is arms crossed. Mm-hmm. And they didn't mean, I don't want to listen to you. They didn't mean that this was closed, but even during worship services, especially if it was a new song and they didn't know how to participate, they would cross their arms. And so I had to really fight with myself mentally to say they are not communicating displeasure, not necessarily. Sometimes they were, but sure. They're not communicating displeasure. They're just that's just their resting pose. And I had one pastor friend that deliberately started serving coffee in their entryway because you can't cross your arms with a cup of coffee in it. And so he said, just to open people up to visitors a little more visually, he would give them a cup of coffee so that they had to stand. The most they could do is maybe tuck a hand in the pocket, or
that's so
it's really
funny.
Awkward to cross one arm. But what it communicates and what people mean, it's just tacit knowledge that, hey, my arms crossed is just I'm resting. There's nothing, I'm not communicating anything. It's what we all do.
And I think, so these examples, I think, are really helpful because they're very observable. But one of the things about this tacit knowledge is that it goes very, very, very deep down to the level of, I think maybe one of the more easily understood examples of this is down to the level of time. So we just all kind of know that time is sequential and that it's a resource to be managed and that it's a way to communicate respect again, except that actually those are cultural understandings. Those are cultural interpretations of time. And they're so accepted that when I suggest to my students or to people I'm doing a workshop with that there's another way of observing time, it's just, it doesn't even make sense that that could be the case, because of course this is the way time works. So it's part of that tacit understanding and the attempt to make it explicit, to bring it out into the open, feels very strange.
Another example would be the way many cultures use to save face or to protect reputation, use passive voice in how they describe things. The dish broke.
Mm-hmm. Or even it broke itself to me.
Right. Right. In the reflexive languages where we would instantly go to, well, did you break it? And our view of that is an honesty, dishonesty thing. And there's underlying things that cultures understand inside those cultures or are just there that we don't always quite grasp if we're not careful.
Well, and even how we, like for the time example, equate time with money. Like if a business isn't open when it says it's going to be open, well, don't they know they're losing business by not being open when they say, but that's not, again, I think when we were in Mexico for a time, it was like, oh, like everybody is shut down during a certain period of time or they're not doing business. And we're like, but it's the business day. Isn't that important to them? Like it feels baffling when you're coming from your own way of doing things. To realize that we equate certain things together.
So what would be another word that you could use for tacit knowledge? I know that's kind of the educated term for it, and I understand that, but we're really talking about the deep under the water parts of the iceberg.
Yeah, I mean, you could say hidden. I think the difficulty with the word hidden is that almost sounds like somebody went and hid it, you know, and it's not that.
Or it's a secret or something
right.
Like that.
Yeah, like it's an intentional secret. And I think that's a bit misleading.
These are discoverable and learnable
right.
pieces of culture that we can adjust to and even begin to enjoy.
Yeah. And then the other piece with that is just to kind of keep in mind the limitation of the iceberg. They also do change over time, not usually very quickly, but they do change. And so just because you have discovered it, it doesn't mean you have discovered it in its essence, like that, okay, now I understand this culture. Like, no, now you understand this element of this culture in this context at this time, right? So it's more that you learn a way of seeing than it is that you actually are gaining the content. You mentioned curiosity, and it's like this, it's really important to stay curious, because if you feel like, okay, now I've got it, then you've got problems.
Which is where the kind of philosophical Epicurean mindset of the river keeps flowing and I'll never step in the same river twice
right,
is
right.
important to have.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even being like someone who is from a place versus someone who has lived there for a long time, like even, like I feel like there are ways that when you're from a place and have lived there a long time, I don't know, maybe you can see how it's changing, or maybe you don't see it, but you feel it, and you couldn't describe to someone why it's that way. So it's like even someone who has lived in a place for a long time but didn't grow up there, didn't have like a parent or somebody to like say, this is how we do things or this is how it's changing. Like, I feel like there are even differences in the learning and the understanding of why things change or how they change.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's the historical connection can sometimes be really healthy. Sometimes that because we live in a country that has changed cultures in a large way. You have a Berlin Wall that falls down, and all of a sudden you have a communist country and a capitalist country merging. Mm-hmm. And so there are people that had lived in another culture that are now living in the middle of a different culture. And their history plays a completely different role, because mm-hmm. it's the way it used to be for them is really sometimes hard to navigate.
Hmm. Yeah, even how we view our own history and how it affects us today, and then how that bleeds into the future. Yeah. Our understanding.
I remember, so my mom taught international students English at our house for a long time when I was growing up. And I remember at some point, one of her students had backed up out of the driveway and hit the car of another student who was parked on the street, I think waiting for their lesson. So both of these were international students from different parts of the world. And the student who had hit the car apologized to the one whose car they'd hit. And it was just clear that forgiveness had not happened, or, you know, that the relationship wasn't okay. And this went on for a long time. I want to say it was maybe a couple of months that, like, things were not okay. And finally, what was discovered, and I don't know who discovered it, was that the student who had hit the car needed to apologize to the family of the car that was damaged, because it was the whole family, and I think particularly the wife of that family, that was inconvenienced by that car being out of action while it was being repaired. And for the family whose car was damaged, that was just obvious. Of course you would apologize to the family. And it was infuriating that the student who had caused the damage wouldn't do that. But they didn't realize that their expectation that the apology would be to the whole family was a cultural expectation, in the same way that the student who had caused the damage didn't realize that the expectation that apologizing to the one who had happened to be driving that day wasn't sufficient, because in their cultural context, that was the way you apologize. I mean, I think there were flowers that were exchanged. There were like all of these different ways of saying apology to the one person, to the driver, and none of them were sufficient. So even though both cultures acknowledged the fault in the same way, in a similar way, and acknowledged the need for an apology, and even though both wanted to get to a place of being okay relationally, like there was no intent to not reconcile the relationship, but there was just this, on both sides, this tacit understanding, unexpressed understanding, maybe there's a word for us, of how forgiveness should happen, and the fact that it wasn't happening, or how the apology should happen, and the fact that it wasn't happening, was this barrier to something that everybody wanted.
Yeah, that's a great story. It reminds me.
It's also
me
a better story because they did eventually figure it out and find reconciliation.
Yeah. Before I move on to the next question, are there things that we've maybe that we want to go back and say anything more about?
I think another way in which it's important to be looking for these kind of tacit understandings has to do with questions of identity. So sometimes we'll use the language of individualism and collectivism. You know, do you identify first as an individual and then as part of a group, or first as part of a group and then as an individual? Because within those cultural contexts, whether individualistic or collectivist, that identity order, that identity priority, the identity structure makes sense and is understood and expected and does not have to be articulated. It's just the context in which every other element of life is done. But when you move across those differences, it's quite disorienting. But it's disorienting often not right away, but like at some point you realize like we're just not having the same conversation, even if we're using the same words. Another thing like that, so I mentioned time, individualism, collectivism. We talked about power distance and authority. There are all sorts of communication strategies. We talked some about the way that you would, you know, make eye contact or where you would stand, but also just down to, I think you talked about directness and indirectness. And to realize that like for cultures that communicate directly, direct communication works and is respectful. And for cultures that communicate indirectly, indirect communication works and is respectful, and is not necessarily dishonest, which just like direct communication is not necessarily honest, right? Like, but often people from a direct culture will perceive people from indirect cultures as being dishonest because I don't understand what they're saying, you know? And then we assume that we're honest because we're communicating directly, and that's often not the case. So it goes on and on and on. You know, what does it mean when you raise your voice when you're having some kind of a conflict? Does it mean I've lost control because I'm just that angry, or does it mean I'm emotionally invested? And of course, for any individual person, that can vary. But what's really interesting is that there are these variations that are happening at the group level. And if we don't realize that somebody's functioning within their group context and within the accepted norms of how you communicate within conflict, it can really cause major misunderstandings.
When you guys came from your family cultures and decided to make a new Jones family culture, even if that wasn't the way you looked at marriage, what were some of the cultural disorientations that you guys experienced?
Even referencing conflict, for sure, like how we did conflict was very different. And that had to do with direct and indirectness, yelling or not yelling, when it was appropriate to yell and when not, or when there was a line crossed. That definitely felt like, it feels like the one that we're just learning how to do it. And we've been married 16 years.
Right? It'll be 17.
It'll be 17.
And by the time this episode comes out.
Yeah. So it's one of those ones that, you know, changes and morphs and, you know, through the years. But even, yeah, as you're, like, literally just the other day, we were fighting about something. And Stephen didn't, it seemed to me that he didn't feel like I was responding to him in a way that I meant what I was saying. And I'm like, do you just want me to yell at you? And then you would think that I am 100% invested in what you're saying?
Yeah, kind like, of.
So like, is that...
Just talk like, loudly.
and it's not that I like never raise my voice. I raise my voice a lot because as a family, growing up on a ranch, you yell all the time.
But it doesn't mean the same thing.
No, yeah. You just talk very loudly or yell from the house to the barn, or there's a tractor going on in the background, so you're talking loudly, or there's a lot of people in the room, so to have a conversation, you're talking very loudly. So I talk loudly.
There's a side of my family that if you aren't animated, if you're not emotionally present in the conflict, it means you're not present in the conflict. And so there's this framework where you look at emotional restraint and emotional expressiveness, you know, and the strategies are opposite. There's a continuum between them, but the strategy on the emotional expressiveness side is you demonstrate relational commitment through emotional expression. So I'm going to let you know I care by raising my voice. And actually, I'm going to give you the emotional information that you need to know how I'm doing. You can see it, right? When you need to worry is when that all goes internal and then you can't see it anymore. Whereas on the emotionally restrained side, it's the opposite, right? I'm going to manage my emotions so that they don't affect you, so that we can have this kind of neutral space to have a disagreement. When I actually start expressing emotionally, then I've lost control, right? And the problem, of course, is that both of those strategies, when they're interacting across, you know, with the other strategy, end up communicating either I'm not trustworthy or I'm not invested or I don't care. And then if one of the people crosses over to match the other one, it means that they, in fact, have lost control, you know. And so it may feel like, okay, now we're really getting somewhere. And actually, you're not. At that point, the conflict is no longer, there's no meaningful progress happening. And then there's also the directness and indirectness. My family is much more direct than Jenny's family is in terms of dealing with conflict.
Communication in general.
In general, right.
Usually it happens. So communication happens via a central hub. For our family, it's like my mom and dad are sort of a central hub, and communication gets, you know, spread throughout, you know, so it's not usually
but the
directly
conflict communication
communicated.
Especially gets routed through.
But even just general information. That's true. When are we getting together? We'll ask mom and dad. They know. Like, they've had conversations with everybody, so it's almost like, for efficiency's sake, I'm not going to go ask everyone. I'm just going to ask mom and dad because they know, because everyone else is communicating with them.
But sometimes that's true, even if we're getting together, just us with one of your siblings, right? Like, your parents don't even have to be part of that event for that to be the communication routing.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes sense from a ranching background,
yeah.
though, right? I mean, you need to check in with dispatch to find out what's going on.
Exactly, yeah.
With conflict, that can be really hard, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that still happens a lot. And I think that's some personality, not just that's like a family specific.
And
not
my family will kind of like, okay, well, let's lay out all the things that happened. Let's, you know, can we get a timeline of this? When, you know, and so when exactly did I offend you? Was it here? No, what you're saying there doesn't quite make sense. Could it have been the moment before that? You know, and we'll just break it all down. But then, of course, there's also the side of my family that's very emotionally expressive while we're doing that. So it's like, I didn't say that. You know, like yeah.
So you're describing it really logically, although the emotional response from somebody else might look completely passion, not
right.
logic.
Yep.
Interesting.
So yeah, definitely that communication piece. I mean, there are loads of other things.
Well, time.
Yeah, time is a big one.
For me, time is more fluid. When you're on time, when does it feel okay to be on time? I'm a little bit more like, I mean, we're going to walk into church on the early side. We might miss the beginning of the song and it's fine. We'll just scooch in the back.
And I'm like, so then we're late.
You're like, no, we're on time.
Part of what's interesting is for me, that's actually a cultural adaptation. My actual
family is super late.
Well, it depends on which side of the family. But
which member of the family are you talking about?
But yeah, my kind of base orientation toward time is that it's quite fluid and, you know, we'll get there when we get there. But I have adapted culturally, and part of this, I think, is being a third culture kid.
And your dad being a part of the military, what did he say is
those
on time?
Two things
He's
together.
He's very punctual, like over-punctual. Over-punctual. That's how it feels to me, personally.
You know he's listening to this.
I know.
Okay.
But it's...
Well, I mean, okay. My dad was the same way, 10 minutes early is late.
If you want to. Anyways.
So I have made these cultural adaptations to valuing being on time, not because I value them, but because I participate in cultural spaces where it matters. So then that's been a tension point between us. I'm like, why am I the one that's caring about time? I don't actually care.
No.
And yet.
And there are lots of other ways that you don't care about time that bother me.
but then when it comes to, you know, something that where I feel like, no, this actually in this cultural context, it matters, that I'm very conscious of the time. Yeah. My guess, so, I feel like you're sitting there like, fight, fight.
No, it's just funny because it's similar to the way Alyssa and I work with time, and we're, I'm super punctual and again, military kid. So 10 minutes early is late and want to be there early to the point where I'm sometimes, from a German perspective, 10 minutes early is rudely early. And so if you're coming to somebody's house, and so there've been plenty of times where I've found myself walking around the block or waiting outside until it's time so I can actually ring the bell and go up. But there are other things from a German culture where you show up at and this really helped Alyssa, the trains run for the most part on schedule. You show up at a tram station and you see how many minutes I have. I can check on my phone and I see how many minutes I have, and they don't care. They don't care if you're running 3 minutes late. So it's different than with a car. Mm-hmm. You show up on time for the train, or especially on a Sunday morning, it's 10 minutes till the next one comes. And so you just have to be punctual. And that, having somebody not named Mike that sets those schedules of punctuality has been helpful for us getting to places on time together.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
We're going to end our conversation with Stephen and Jenny Jones today. On that note, we'll pick up in part 3, where we'll finish the conversation with them again, pre-recorded. I'm just cutting off the editing here so we can keep it at a good length for you to listen to. If you are a director of a ministry that is interested in using the Cross-Cultural Transition Handbook, customizing it for your organization, you can find information in the show notes about how to get in touch with Stephen Jones and open up that conversation with him. If you'd like to email us, you can do that at podcast@envisionberlin.com. You can also join our Discord server, and you'll find the link to that inside of the show notes. Unterwegs, the En Route podcast, is a production of I Am Intercultural, a division of Exigent Communication, in partnership with Envision Berlin. Please like, share, and subscribe. Podcast music is by Mike Picanato.